Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, stationary this time, not tailgating anybody in my car, as a matter of fact. And I'm joined by Nick Osello. We're recording this on Monday morning. So, Nick, as far as I can tell, you have yet to have your first Coors Light.
Correct. And with Lent coming up, which, by the way, big Lent guy over here, credit to me, I feel like the Coors Lights are going to go down significantly in consumption, especially on Monday mornings.
We are recording this on President's Day morning in order to observe all the political nature of this show. So get ready for those heating jokes to get fired off is probably a better way of saying that. But we've got a huge weekend of college lacrosse to talk about. So why don't you take it away?
And before we get started, I feel like we did miss an opportunity to make tailgate jokes as you were driving. So credit to us for being safe. We never condone tailgating. But yes, welcome to the official week one of college lacrosse. Now you might be wondering, hey, weren't there other teams playing? Aren't teams three games in? Hey, none of that. The season starts when Notre Dame plays its first game, which they did. And as much as I want to sit here and talk about this Notre Dame, really, really impressive start to the season, there were better games, hand up, I admit it. In my opinion, the biggest game of the weekend was Army beating Rutgers. Terry, do you want to start off here with that spicy meatball?
Absolutely. There's no better place to start.
Army rebounds after losing to UMass, which many thought was a pretty big upset in that wild week 0.5. And Reese Burke, first off, thank you for having an easy name to get things rolling here. You had 5 goals. Congratulations.
Nope. It's Burke. B-U-R-E-K.
Nope. Burke. B-U-R-K-E. Burke. Both teams had good runs. Rutgers with a 4-goal run in the second. Army responded, going up 10-6. And what impressed me was Army's good outside shooting. It opened up a lot of things. A lot of them must have been attending sniper camp. Ha ha ha, good one. Terry, is Army good or is Rutgers bad?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's still a first of all, they're both good. Now, are they both like 6-12 good? Which I think is probably like a realistic expectation for Rutgers, or are they like 10-17 good? And it's too early to decide. And I think that you make the right point, which is how good is UMass as a function of this? The Minutemen are 2-0. Their second win came over UMass Lowell on Friday. Not a ton to glean from that one, as Drew Kelleher still tries to find his footing there in that in-state rivalry. As far as this one, I rewatched it this morning, and a couple things jumped out. So the first is, it's hard to play on the road, and we'll get to this when we talk about Loyola. But you know, I do think that for Rutgers, that was a factor, particularly when you look at slow starts and the way in which they can essentially linger. Because ultimately, this was a 1-goal game on the road where they had an opportunity to tie with a shot that hit the post with 10 seconds to go. There's almost no margin between these two teams on that basis. So, you know, a couple things that stood out to me that were interesting, particularly in the context of that slow start, was that Rutgers' first 2 goals came on backside looks and basically just terrible off-ball defense from Army. So from that standpoint, like, they settled in. And over the course of the game, really forced Rutgers to beat them dodging. And I thought that Rutgers, by and large, they did that. This was a game in which both goalies were under 50%. You know, and I thought that Kyle Mullen, who is the more experienced of the two, wanted a few back, particularly in the second quarter when Army extended their lead a little bit. The game really slowed down in the third and then picked up in the fourth. And I thought that Army really rode momentum. This was a game in which, you know, like I said, 1-goal game, the last goal was scored with 4.5 minutes to go. There were a lot of opportunities down the stretch, and both defenses buckled down. I say all of that to say that because we're early in the season and we don't know how good the perceived good teams are and we don't know how bad the perceived bad teams are, you kind of have to just, like, say how good did this game look, right? So for instance, Hopkins, Carolina, game didn't look very good. It was pretty sloppy. This game looked pretty good to me. So I'm gonna shade toward both these teams are like right around top 10 teams I do think Rutgers' ceiling is a little higher by virtue of their talent and experience relative to Army. But I was impressed by, you know, Army did the thing that I think a lot of teams have to do. And again, you know, saw this with Loyola last week. Like, you need to give your young guys time to work into the game. And Burke is experienced, right? And so you saw some of their, you know, kind of secondary contributors kind of feel their way into the game and play better as the game went on. And I think that's what you have to do when you're playing a bunch of young guys. So huge win for Army, the type of win that, you know, keeps you in the at-large conversation if you don't win the Patriot League automatic bid. And for Rutgers, I guess, you know, this is a little spin zone-y, but probably that slice of humble pie that you need in order to play with the requisite anger with a really highly ranked Loyola team coming to town next weekend.
So what? One of the things that I'm curious to get your feedback on, one, nothing more demoralizing than a goalie that's not playing particularly well or up to their level that they know that they can. And I felt that was particularly bad for Rutgers because you tweeted out a couple clips earlier. When your goalie's not having a good day, you kind of have to go respect those outside shots, which allowed for Army offensive players to, you know, face dodge and absolutely toast that aggressive that you kind of have to play with. Does a lot of this hinge on the goaltending performance from Rutgers, or are we saying, maybe these Army's outside shooters are good, and that's something that Army learned about themselves that they can now take into games moving forward?
Well, certainly when you watched Harvard last year and then you watched Harvard this year in their game against Virginia, which we will get to, you can put a lot of stock in the fact that Kyle Mullen was pretty good. And, you know, I don't want to default to I don't know because the sample size isn't big enough. I think that Kyle Mullen is better than 40%. You know, he had 11 saves and let in 14. Now, I don't think he's going to be 55 to 60% against good teams. So I think from that standpoint, Rutgers, you know, basically the shots that they're going to be willing to give up. It's so funny because now I'm thinking about Colin Kirst, and I think he's one of the more underrated players of the last 2 years because I think a lot of people regarded very highly his ability to start their transition. And I know I spoke about that and how impressed I was by Rutgers' ability to run without Kirst. But at the same time, like, you know, he's so big and he had such a good career that, like, I don't know, maybe they just need to redefine exactly the types of quality shots that, or, you know, low quality shots that they want to give up as a defense and balance that aggressive closeout that you're talking about, before the scouting report comes. You know, they're a really susceptible team to be attacked off of, you know, backside looks and redodges.
And well, it's relatively difficult because Army winning this game, which was a very close game, I'm finding things to speak highly of Army about and kind of dog on Rutgers. Now, granted, that's because, you know, if Jules Henneberg listens to this podcast, I want to make sure that I get an angry text from him. I don't know if Rutgers is going to win another game this season.
Well, then you support the troops.
And I support the troops. I'm a big Army guy. You know, I served in the Air Force as their coach for a year. So, you know, got to support the military guys. But that, like, that is a huge green light. If you have good outside shooters, it just opens up so much. So it's that fine balance. And honestly, I want to get ahead of something here, Terry. We're not here to say, I don't know, and there's context. We're here to give blind confidence is the name of the game. So
I'll do 10 push-ups after this podcast as penance for not living up to the hot take artist nature of this that you demand.
You know, one of the last things, Army plays Rutgers 10 times. What do you think the record is there?
5-5.
Army and Rutgers play 11 times. What do you think the...
Rutgers 6, Army 5.
Okay. Wow. Unbelievable. Now we're cooking with oil. Any other takeaways from this game?
Get 15 push-ups.
Any other takeaways from this game that you noticed? Any final thoughts?
Let's keep it moving.
Got it. Speaking of people that I want to piss off, I am happy and thrilled, and it brings a Christmas joy that only lacrosse fans, and I'm happy to announce that Hopkins fans, Johns Hopkins fans, are back to being miserable. You guys had a little glimmer of hope, and then it was snatched away. They lose back-to-back games. Tuesday, they lost to UNC 7-11, and then Saturday to Loyola 8-13. Granted, two formidable opponents. It's not like they lost to two bad teams. So starting off the season beating Jacksonville and Georgetown, good. Losing back-to-back games, obviously bad. And again, kind of one thing that stood out to me was they couldn't put UNC away even though they were up. I think that was the story of game number one. Not having that consistency. We talked about it last week about having kind of a breadth of offensive depth. Well, turns out that they weren't able to put them away. And speaking of lack of offensive depth, they couldn't score to save their lives, only netting two goals in the first 45 minutes versus Loyola. So some offensive woes against Loyola, some inconsistencies against UNC. Where does Hopkins stand after these two losses?
The first thing is they have to get healthy, because the difference between what they were able to show in their good stretches versus Carolina versus what they showed throughout their game against Loyola when they were playing without Jacob Angeles and Russell Melendez was night and day. I mean, it literally looked like, you know, the game could have gone on for another, you know, 10 quarters and they would still have struggled. It was only Loyola taking their foot off the gas, I felt, that allowed Hopkins to put those last six goals in the net in the fourth quarter. So Angeles and Melendez, I'm told that they both sustained head injuries in that Carolina game and are recovering. Their return is to be determined. And, you know, Hopkins' schedule changes a little bit with they host Utah and then they take on St. Joe's before having Virginia in a midweek game over the course of their next 17 days. So, I mean, just an incredible start to their season in terms of playing seven games in like 40 some days. So going to be a tough test, and they need those guys back. Carolina, it's a little bit of what we talked about. They had opened their season 5 days prior against Mercer. They have so many new guys, whether it be transfers or young guys, that they needed to essentially just tread water until those guys developed the cohesion offensively and put themselves in a position to make plays. I felt like Hopkins got really casual when they were up 6-4 in the third quarter and opened the door for Carolina to walk through. And to their credit, Carolina did. But then when you put that win in the context of how much they struggled offensively against Ohio State 5 days later, then you start to, wonder about some of the aspects of what Hopkins was doing, particularly playing defense by goalie. And, you know, Timmy Marcille has off to a great start for the Blue Jays in goal. You know, he's had a really interesting career. He was awesome in their stretch run in 2021 and then didn't start in 22 as Josh Kurson, the Ohio State transfer, got the start. And then he comes back and he's over 60% through four games. But probably the injury to insult that you saw at the end of that Loyola game was he left the game with about 3 minutes to go. It was unclear at the time what happened. When he was walking through the handshake line, he was kind of holding his left arm as if it was a collarbone injury or something to that effect. But then after that, I saw him kind of dapping up the Loyola players, and he was using his left arm. So rewatching it, he took essentially two successive knees to the head when he fell. So leads me to believe that it's yet another head injury for the Blue Jays, and if he is so instrumental as he has been, that obviously doesn't portend well for Johns Hopkins going forward. So again, you know, I think ultimately they clearly aren't as good as they looked like they might be against Jacksonville and Georgetown. We saw Jacksonville immediately respond with a win over Duke. We have seen Georgetown now fall to 0-2 with a loss to Penn. That being said, they are better than they looked over the course of these last 5 to 5.5 quarters versus Carolina and Loyola, partially because they need to get healthy and partially because they need to play with a little bit more urgency than they did down the stretch against the Blue Jays. But the other side of the coin is, you know, the Greyhounds' defensive improvement year over year is pretty shocking. I think that a lot of it starts from what you talked about with respect to Rutgers' defense, the confidence in your goalie and the way that it allows you to play within the game plan as an individual defensive player. So essentially not having to fly out to shooters, not stretching either on the backside to create interior creases or, you know, on the front side in ways that create interior creases right behind you, and putting shooters in positions for, you know, 13-yard step downs outside the hash, you know, and then increasingly lower angles that might get a little closer, but you feel confident in Luke Stout to stop those. He obviously made 19 saves against, or 18 saves against Maryland, and then backed that up with 10 saves and allowing only 5 goals before he was pulled against Johns Hopkins. And, you know, Loyola is enormous defensively. The insertion of Alex Bean as a starter, as the third starter, alongside Cam Wires and Matt Hughes, who both returned from last year, make them, I believe, 6'6", 6'5", 6'4". And that manifested in their passing lanes, the way that they were able to knock down and intercept passes. And then the thing that impresses me most is how good they are at ending possessions by picking up loose balls in their own defensive zone. And they, you know, really played with a lot of scrappiness. You were very complimentary of their short sticks against, you know, coming away from
who won't
Maryland
be named.
Game. And
we're never going to say their names, but yes.
Well, I got to say, I was a little hesitant to agree with you, but I feel more strongly that you were right now, having seen another 60 minutes. And I think, I'll put it this way, Peyton Rusanka is awesome, but it was the depth that I was concerned about. And the next three guys, it's funny that you're so adamant that they won't be named when Mustang Sally has one of the best names in college lacrosse.
Call me an old school guy. Defensive midfielders shouldn't be named. They're a faceless, thankless position, and I will treat them accordingly as such.
What is a better name, Mustang Sally or Max McGillicuddy?
I mean, Max McGillicuddy is a objectively funnier name. Mustang Sally is what everybody on planet Earth would be prefer to be named. So,
well, they both scored a goal, picked up a ground ball, and caused a turnover. That needs to be like that stat, like 1-1-1. That we need to like coin that term, because that is like the perfect day for a D-man.
It really is. So first off, 100 different ways I could go, but let's focus on me being right for a second. Maybe that's the gratitude that we provide, and they can only be named if they have the 1-1-1, the You Get a Name award. You know what? Congratulations. You guys get your names mentioned on a podcast. Don't get complacent. You're going to need to do that every week. We did go in about 100 different directions right there. We'll have some closing thoughts on Hopkins, because dare I say, you're telling me that I'm right and you agreeing. Let's revisit to what we were saying about Johns Hopkins, where we were talking about the depth and the number of options that they had offensively, potentially being intentional by Crowley, potentially having good impacts on practice, but we saw that two of their main contributors being out appeared to have, and quick aside, everybody get better, head injuries are a scary thing, wish you the best. Terry didn't say that, I'm a great guy. But their two players being out seem to have a nonlinear impact, which would be in contrast with what we were talking about, which was the amount of weapons. So
it's
were
about
we wrong?
Rules, though. No,
okay,
we weren't
never,
wrong.
Never.
You're right. We were not wrong. It's about roles. Jacob Angel. We didn't say that they had incredibly deep stable of passers. We didn't say that they had an incredibly deep stable of attackmen who can dodge a long pole and get his own. And that's what they lost, right? They lost their best passer in Jacob Angelis, who might be their only good passer based on what we saw. They had one assist against Loyola. And then they lost their end of shot clock creator in Melendez, who, you know, you can overreact, I guess, to what he has produced. But he just, I mean, we talked about this with Max Wahlbaum, too. He's their best athlete, most physical, strongest, fastest guy. So he's the one who takes on the number one matchup and can, you know, he's not going to have a great day, so he's not going to put up All-American numbers, but he's going to have a good enough day that it's going to prevent them from switching the matchup and being able to totally erase somebody else. And so, you know, the ability to, you know, run 6 or 7 or 8 guys out of the box and have them serviceably do a job, whether it's hit a step down, move the ball to the backside, dodge off the catch, whatever it is, like they've got depth in that area. But you know, Matt Collison and Brennan Grimes showed themselves as being the only guys that could really attack, and the ball movement suffered dramatically. So, you know, when those two, Grimes and Collison, are big and they're fast and they're strong, and so they can attack matchups, but when they're dodging the number one defenseman and the long stick midfielder, it's going to have a much different effect than if Wires is guarding Melendez, Grimes is on the first midfield, and Collison's on the second midfield. You know what I mean? So it's like the way in which the cascading effect changed the roles is what undermined their depth.
Got it. So depth in 75s across the board, Madden ratings, but maybe they don't have the guy, you know, a stable of guys with 95 speed. So exactly. You know what? Good take. We will, anything on Hopkins before I move on to Loyola, because I think you made a good point there on the size of the defenseman. Everybody sees a big defense and goes, wow, what a nightmare matchup for, you know, a Dodger. This is going to be a big physical game. They're going to be sore. They, I feel like, have solidified themselves as the best team in Maryland after taking down Maryland and Hopkins.
Best team in the Big Ten, too.
What? Ooh, yeah. But I think you said it. The thing that impressed me the most was using their size to just fill up space in passing lanes and not letting Hopkins really have any vision or flow to their offense. So when you see big defenses, yes, there's the chance that it's going to be a Tucker Durkin-esque, you know, black and blue arm after the game for attackmen, but don't discount the impact that it has on skip lanes and on the reach. And, you know, just picture a bunch of 6'7" basketball players. You're not going to be able to squeeze those passes through. And their stick skills and positioning are as impressive, well, not as impressive as their size, but certainly manageable and a nightmare. Is this the best defense in college lacrosse?
Right now, yeah. You know, I think there are people claiming that they're the best team in college lacrosse right now, which seems a little aggressive, but also justifiable in some respects. But yeah, I think that what they've put on tape, you know, is, to me, like, there just isn't, you know, there's not an optimal place you want to attack, right? You know, their second long stick midfielder, Diego Roman, picked up 3 ground balls. He played great against Maryland. Like, I mean, those are the types of spots where you expect goals to come from. You know, we haven't seen him. I'm interested in how their man down plays, you know, across a larger sample. But yeah, there's no clear deficiency. And you know, it'll be interesting too. I think you can expect their offense to get better as the year goes on because they're playing freshmen and because they're going to get Joey Kamish back from injury. He warmed up on Saturday, but still, you know, arguably their best offensive player, maybe second behind Poitras, and he hasn't played yet. So you would expect their offense to get better. You'd expect their faceoff guy, their faceoff unit to get better, which we already saw from game one to game two. And that gives them a little bit of cushion for their defense to not have to play at the level that they've played in these first two games and still be able to win. Charlie Toomey said post-game that he thought that Rutgers was going to be their stiffest stiffest matchup offensively. Uh-huh. And that's probably going to be true. And so it'll be another good opportunity to evaluate them. But really, I think that the most important thing that you'll be able to take away from this Loyola at Rutgers game is how the Greyhounds travel. You know, they've won these two games and they're impressive, but they were both at home. And, you know, I mentioned it with respect to what it meant for Rutgers going to Army. And I think that, you know, it all wraps up into if they can go to Rutgers, go to 3-0 in the Big Ten and on the season, and basically prove that they travel as well as they play at home, you know, then it's another step forward in terms of their four realness.
And to highlight one last time how important it is, I feel like depth on defense is, it's always mentioned, but it's never talked about on how, like, demoralizing that is. You know, reflecting on my personal experience going up against the Duke teams that I can't remember which house brother, H-A-U-S, Will or John, I don't know, Control-C, Control-V. But when I would be getting ready to dodge them or...
Well, it was Will. If it was Duke, it was Will.
Okay.
Because John played at Maryland.
Yep, I get it mixed up every single time, and I know you wouldn't. So good. I just knew it was house on the roster, number 6. And he was good enough to where... Even going into the games, we were a little concerned with our ability to run a structured and clear offense because he was such a threat that we knew we would have to be completely dialed. And essentially, it's like having long pull out there.
Was he a threat from, like, dodging? Like, you couldn't dodge and win the matchup? Or was he a threat from taking the ball away from whoever was trying
to? No, you couldn't dodge and win the matchup, which is potentially even more frustrating, because that's the crux of damn near every single offense that you run is, okay, we have the short stick matchup, let's dodge and make them slide. Dodging against a shorty and not having the slide come to you is kind of like a slap in the face. So when that happens consistently, like we've seen Loyola be able to manage, and, like, you know, granted you have a freaking, you know, 6'5" guy coming to slide in the first place, I think that is going to be something that takes Loyola pretty deep. Like, they're a Final Four team if they stay healthy and if their short stick D-middies can do good, just because, like, I just remember hating House so much. So, little personal aside there. And
let's talk about another team that you hate in the North Carolina Tar Heels.
You know what? I was just getting ready to tee that up. So we talked about UNC winning. Let's discuss a personal favorite topic of mine, which is UNC losing. They lost to Ohio State. Ohio State took them down in an absolute snoozer of a game, 8-5. A big moment for the geezers of the lacrosse community. Nothing too exciting in this game to keep them awake past their 4 p.m. bedtime. Everybody got their warm glass of milk and went to bed. Both goalies playing well. You know?
Hold on. Before you move on from that, how glaring was, like, Sunday, the Monday after the Super Bowl is always like a, what am I going to watch? And it's the biggest day for college basketball. The Sunday, like, we had Daytona 500 and the NBA All-Star Game, but, like, from noon to 4 p.m., like, the XFL, like, I mean, it was college lacrosse and the XFL, and golf, I guess, but, like, the XFL, I mean, I just, a minute of your thoughts.
You know?
Did you consider trying out for the XFL?
No, I stunk at football. People are so good at football. No, I did not try. I haven't watched a single play. I won't. And honestly, I'm torn between two things. One, let's not overload on football. The break makes things good. If you drink every single day, you're an alcoholic and those beers start to taste less good. If you watch football year round, the beautiful moments of college football, the beautiful moments of the NFL don't feel as beautiful. So I'm going to be taking a break. I'm not going to be watching the XFL. And going off of the back, honestly, bald brothers are supposed to stick together. Kind of getting sick of The Rock being all over the place. Like, I want to see something that doesn't end up going back to The Rock pretending to be a hype man. So I am abstaining from the XFL for now. The only reason I will watch is because my cousin married Eric Dungy, who's a quarterback for the Renegades. So I'm a big Dallas Renegades fan. I think that's the right team. If he's playing, I'm the number one fan in the entire world. If not, I'm not watching, and no one can make me. So stop asking, to quote Nick Saban. Anyways, now that I'm all fired up about
this. This is exactly what I wanted. Exactly what I wanted.
Back to another great topic of UNC losing. So both goalies played well. 12 and 13 saves. Creditable defenses. I feel like no offense really had an inch to work with. And in the theme of what we're talking about seemingly all episode, both defenses exerting pressure in a way that didn't really allow offenses to get settled. I will say this is going to be the first Atmosphere of the Weekend gold medalist crown. It was sold out at Ohio State, standing room only. And for it being a snoozer of the game, the fourth quarter was electric. Ohio State mounting a comeback, everybody getting all fired up. It's one of those, like, if you go back and watch the, watch the highlights even, you know, the Ohio State scores to make it 4-4 in the fourth, which is kind of a pathetic goal, honestly. Really, the fourth goal. But it was cool because the entire place goes nuts. They've been deprived of any good offensive streaks. The bench goes nuts, so honestly, a great atmosphere for a snoozer of the game. I would have liked to be there to watch UNC lose. Maybe play a game of beer pong in the parking lot.
Okay, that you have met your quota for say something nice about Ohio State. I think that buys you at least three references of referring to shutting them out. I can't believe that you didn't work that into their offensive struggles, etc. For this rundown. It comes as no surprise to see Colin Krieg play well. He has been a stabilizing force for the Tar Heels, both this season and in years prior. And then Skylar Walland has increasingly played better for the Buckeyes, too. It's interesting. I had a conversation in December about, you know, there was questions about whether Marcus Hutchins was going to be eligible for this season. And on the assumption that he was going to be and paired with Bobby Van Buren, what it meant for their approach overall, essentially how much it could have allowed for them to play a no sliding scheme, because they were going to be so athletic and so sticky on ball that you could potentially plan to just never slide and be, you know, be okay with teams essentially scoring only when they could dodge and get their own, which would have been interesting from what it meant for Jacob Snyder's role, because he's the very clear communicator, third guy, or, you know, he's the slide man on the inside, et cetera. And then Cullen Brown, who's a, you know, young guy who kind of is in that Bobby Van Buren, Marcus Hudgens lockdown style mold. And then, you know, Justin Scher is a transfer from Maryland who provided more depth at the LSM. You know, they have two short 16 middies who are from my alma mater, and I think are, you don't have to slide to them, in Connor Camille and Greg Langermeyer. So
congrats on having an alma mater.
Thank you. They still play lacrosse there. I know that that's a sore subject for you. This is what you hope to see when you were speculating about what Marcus Hudgens' insertion into this defense was going to look like. I'm going to rewatch this one after we finish recording, and I'm sure I'll have more to say about it then, which it doesn't really serve this podcast very well. But you know, I also think that for everything good that you can say about Ohio State's defense, you kind of have to offset it by saying something good about Carolina's defense if you limit Jack Myers to one goal and one assist. So even though, you know, Ohio State can be comfortable or feel good about an 8-5 defensive slugfest, Nick Myers clearly was excited about how rare
almost
it is
too
in
excited.
The shot clock
era. He was really fired up about a low-scoring game. So
yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's a coach's dream, right? But at the same time, you know, I want to know how Myers was limited so effectively, because it doesn't happen very often.
This is going to be kind of a recurring theme. We brought it up last episode as well. I feel like this was sneaky, a good little Big Ten versus ACC matchup. I think that these two teams kind of track really well. How much weight are you putting into this representing the respective conferences?
I think Ohio State's awesome. So I think Carolina
wow,
might be the
they,
fifth best
team. I hope they hear
team.
This, bro. Like, they're not going to date you.
I think Ohio State might be the best team in the Big Ten, and I think Carolina might be the worst team in the ACC. And if that is the case, then obviously it bodes really well for the ACC because they played them basically, you know, tied throughout. Now, that being said, I don't think the margins are very wide between Ohio State, Maryland, and Rutgers. And, you know, we don't know how wide the margins are if Carolina, you know, it seems like Carolina, Syracuse, and Duke might all be kind of collectively the three teams lagging behind Virginia and Notre Dame. But that margin could be pretty small, too. So, you know, honestly, even though it was a loss, I think this is probably a win in terms of the ACC's perception against the Big Ten coming off of last year.
Oh, that's just what I wanted to hear. That's just...
What, a moral victory for the ACC? That's
little,
what you need?
Finally, the historically underserved ACC catches a break in a close loss. Love to hear it.
Well, wins over Marquette and Cleveland State are going to absolutely just separate you from the
UNC pack, sure. Has not proven themselves because they haven't beaten Marquette and Cleveland, or Detroit Mercy.
No, Cleveland State.
Cleveland
State. They played Detroit Mercy last year.
Yeah.
They beat Detroit.
I don't know. It's all the same two bye weekends. With full respect to those two programs,
Horizon League team.
All right. Well, so in other news, the Chinese.
Let's talk about an ACC versus Ivy League.
I would love to. I just would love to. Especially, you know, an Ivy League team that might have unjustly gotten in over an ACC team last year. If you've been paying attention to the news, the Chinese spy balloon was blown up, which was the second biggest explosion that I have heard of recently. The first, Virginia's offense. How about this? You see an over-under. And it's 45.5 for a college lacrosse game. And the over hits. Virginia just slaps Harvard around. Hey, couple big takeaways, Terry. Sit down for this one. Colin, Colin. Damn it, I suck. Schellenberger is good at lacrosse. Went 3 goals and 7 assists for a 10-point outing. 20 goals in the first half. Going into halftime against Harvard, they were up and had 20 points on the board, which is absolutely mind-blowing. Before we go on a step further, if you're looking to get punched in the face, please start slandering Jerry Byrne's name. He's still the college defensive icon. He's a legend. The final was 25-21, which is a bit closer than it may have seemed. The face-off record was broken in this game. I think it was, what, 53?
Yeah. Well, it'll be 52, but that still breaks
the record. Yeah, honestly, need to do something about that. When our team's just going to stop, you know, stop admitting that face-offs have an impact on the game. Lot of things to talk about in this game. Final score wasn't really indicative of how big of a blowout it was. Terry, did you need a cold bath and a cigarette after watching this game?
I needed a nap, that's for sure. You know, it definitely took it out of me. I mean, I tweeted during the game that I had never seen anything like it, and even with, 36 hours of time and space, I would say that that's true. I mean, it looked like Virginia couldn't not score in the first half. It appeared as if they were trying to just run out the clock, the equivalent of rolling the ball into the corner at the end of the shot clock, it would just end up in the net somehow. I mean, it was outrageous. Like, they might have designed some sort of magnetic thing in the ball that attracted it to the back of the net. It was incredible. I mean, the variety of scorers, the variety of ways in which they scored, transition, face-offs, settled, penalties, whatever. It didn't matter. None of it had an effect. No friction. Slide and recovery was kind of really out of sorts. I think that there's a bunch of different ways that you can take this. Again, we have so few games that we got to create these associations. Michigan played Virginia really tough 8 days ago or 9 days ago. Michigan turns around and struggles against a Hofstra team that, doesn't look like they're a top 40 or 50 team in college lacrosse. So what do you take away from that Michigan-Virginia result? And then you flip it around. This is the most dangerous week in terms of drawing bold takeaways because the staggered nature of when teams start and the difference between the challenges that teams face coming away from game one versus not is so broad, right? So, there with Harvard, there are a lot of factors to consider. How much better were they than how good were they relative to the way that their season ended by virtue of being an NCAA tournament team in 22, which obviously sets your expectation or forecast for 23. I saw them in the fall. They were every bit as good as Carolina. I think they won. If they didn't, it was a scrimmage that was decided by one goal, and half the goals were scored with second stringers on the field. So, wins and losses in scrimmages don't matter. And then, how much did they need to improve? How much were they going to improve? What's the balance of freshmen making the sophomore jump? How many freshmen are going to be contributing? There were just so many questions for the Crimson that, they fell behind 9-0 in this game. It's the exact opposite of what I was talking about from the standpoint of Loyola and Army's veterans scoring to buy their young guys opportunity to get their sea legs and the game being played at a slow enough pace and your defense getting enough stops in order to allow your offense to develop that cohesion. Mentioned it with respect to Carolina as well. It wasn't the case in this game. The game was over at the end of the first quarter and certainly by halftime. So, I even wonder how much consolation you can take from putting up 21 and having a good second half performance against a Virginia team that, clearly just didn't want to put up 35 or 40 goals. So just a really hard game to take a lot away from other than, and I would say that's even kind of true for Virginia in the sense that
it's bamboozle, Brent. You can make good cases and bad cases for every team in the country right now. It's kind of wild.
Totally. But Virginia's offense, I don't think it's possible that they would have a day this good again. So they're not going to be this good. Don't watch this game and assume that this is who Virginia is. they're good, right? Virginia Yale would be incredible based on how offense oriented and how fast
53 would be
those
the
two teams play.
It's wild.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, like, you know, they could lose next week. So we'll see.
So
you're
not going to put any weight into a sophomore like Sam King having 7 goals throughout the day. Did you, you know, so it just so I have this clear, Virginia mailed it in so much and kicked the dicks in so hard in the first half that Harvard was able to scramble to a somewhat acceptable final score because Virginia just didn't care at all. That's the primary narrative.
I mean, when you say it that bluntly, it makes me feel bad, but yes.
Yeah, listen, don't want to feel bad about it. Don't give up 20 goals in the first half. I feel like that's a pretty standard argument. Any bright spots for Harvard then at all? I mean, it sounds like you could argue that Virginia just had every single thing bounce their way. Is there an area at all that you can say you're Jerry Byrne in the locker room after the game? Hey, tough go, but
Adam Blinn's will probably start going forward in goal. And, you know, Christian Barnard made 2 saves and got replaced. So, you know, you wonder if you get a couple of those saves early, the entire game flows differently. You know, but, man, did you see Ricky Miazon put a shoulder into, like, 2 or 3 different... like, a lot of that is a 6'2", 235-pound Pac-12 linebacker doing that. But another part of it is just Harvard looked small defensively. So I don't think that's an issue that's going to get solved very easily.
No, tough to, you know, tough to play against genetics, honestly. So, all right, well, with that, UNC beating Hopkins, good for the ACC. Virginia beating Harvard, good for the ACC. Not so fast, my friend. Syracuse, the Achilles heel of last year, had a good tilt against Maryland. So Maryland wins. Faceoffs, again, having too big of an impact. Weirman, who we've talked about as being, you know, if he's not the best in the country, somebody make a case for Tommy Burke better than Weirman. Weirman went 24-31. Daniel Kelly had 4. Jack Corris had 3. The big story to me was Maryland starting hot and being up 3-0 before Cuse even really had a chance. That led to a 7-3 Maryland gap. And while Cuse was impressive somewhat in sticking around, you just can't spot Maryland 3 goals and expect to be walking away. Maryland was balanced and impressive, not really blowing anyone's mind, but not really having any holes. You know, Spolina's back behind the back should have been 2 points. That was one of the crispiest, slickest, and we'll talk about that in a second. And Dante Trader, while having no Fiesta Bowl appearances, had 2 goals on the day, with one being a pretty damn impressive maintained possession as people are baseball bats swinging him. Highlight your athleticism. Use your explosive athleticism to break away at the midline and go in, you know, honestly, just what you want out of a freak athlete on your team. I think that was something that certainly stood out. But you just can't spot Maryland 3 and expect to win.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think this was a showcase of Maryland's professionalism, if that is the right word. Basically, like, you know, first of all, you know, thoughts out to Logan McNanny. We talked about his injury on the podcast last week. John Tillman heartily refuted my speculation that he was injured coming in, and I just want to make it clear, like, that was surmising. That was you know, and it also wasn't a judgment-based comment. It wasn't to say that he shouldn't have been playing. You know, if indeed he was, right, just kind of playing out that speculation, then, you know, my assumption would have been that he was cleared and it was deemed that he was all good to play, and it was then subsequently unfortunate that he got injured. But obviously starting a new goalie in Teddy Dolan, a grad transfer from Binghamton, that, you know, we've talked about goalie play a lot on this podcast already. That clearly is going to have an effect on your team and on your defense. You know, I thought they did a really nice job protecting Colin Burleis relative to the week prior. And I thought that maybe there's an aspect to it where it's like, you know, Syracuse's offense is tiered enough in terms of production and expected contributions that it plays into the hands of Maryland's personnel a little bit. you know. But I thought that, to your point, that they stuck around. It was a lot of Willmark, and you know, had it not been for a day as good as he had, the effect of the faceoffs could have just been even more compounding from the standpoint of, you know, emotional response to the goal margin, as well as the physicality and the effects of the fatigue of having to play that much defense. So there's a lot of silver linings or bright spots to take away if you're Syracuse. And moral victories lead to real losses. I understand that. But at the same time, you know, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, they played well enough to meet the expectations. They didn't play well enough to win if you're Syracuse. You didn't play well enough to win, but you probably shouldn't have expected to win on the basis of the gap between Maryland and Syracuse on a season-long basis last year, not on the basis of that actual game, right, in the Carrier Dome. So you come down to College Park, tough trip, tough environment to play in, and you know, the field was tilted against you. Your goalie kept it close, and your offense got their sea legs and was able to produce a little bit more as the game went on, but it was never really going to be it was never a game that they were going to threaten to win. So, you know, and if you're Maryland, like, you have more injuries to deal with coming away from this one. But at the same time, you know, like I said, the professionalism in the ability to, you know, kind of adopt a next man up. Clearly, they made some other personnel changes that were a reflection to some of the offensive struggles that they had against Loyola. And, you know, that's another aspect of season-long development that I think we all would have expected from Maryland. You know, I didn't expect their, you know, top six and top nine offensively at the beginning of the season to look like what it was going to look like at the end of the season. So, you know, now they're a few games in, they've made some changes, and it comes as no surprise. So, you know, this was one of those games that I feel like checked a lot of boxes, but confirmed a lot of assumptions that folks had around both these teams over the course of the last, you know, month and really 9 months.
Well, it was why I was frustrated watching Maryland last year, because, you know, it kind of started picking up steam. Is this going to be undefeated? I was rooting against them just because I love a good, like, oh, well, they didn't go undefeated. But there was no single facet in which it felt like you could exploit Maryland for, particularly when they have Weirman, who's playing so good that a 3-goal lead all of a sudden feels like a 6-goal lead, because you're not going to be able to get any momentum and score back-to-back goals, because it's going to be, we score a goal, Maryland maintains possession because of a faceoff. So I think that there is that silver lining for Syracuse, knowing that you're going into a game in which you're going to get killed on the faceoff, not having it get away from them at all, and the battle of what's more valuable, like having faceoffs or having a hot goalie. I think having a hot goalie is a great little, like, hey, if we stuck it relatively close with Maryland when they killed us on the faceoff because our goaltender played good, imagine what we can do moving forward when, you know, we figure out a way to go 50-50, or when we work on counters, or when we have the ability to exploit them in some way. Honestly, I think that Syracuse is in a pretty good position, all things considered. So I hate to say that, hate to say it, but I don't know. It was, again, another way of like, all right, Maryland doesn't really have a hole. You're game planning against Maryland. What are you trying to exploit? What was their weakness?
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Nice. That's so, I must be on a roll if you're agreeing with me twice on the same episode. God damn, good job, Nick. So, all right, moving on.
All right, let's keep it moving.
Penn beats Georgetown. Certainly not the start for the season that you wanted in Georgetown. Honestly, this game seemingly was a game of matchups. Sam Hanley versus Will Bowen, Brendan Lavelle versus Tucker Dordovic, some fun ones all game. Honestly, it seemed like the defense all around won individual matchups, and the second slash third options that you might not think of had a big impact, mainly Cam Rubin going 4-for-5. And if this matchup was based on scoring percentage, the sport of lacrosse is canceled, because if you don't count him, Penn's at 12%, Georgetown's at 19% shooting, which is Yikes. Bad. Georgetown starts the season off with 2 losses. Is it time for Georgetown fans and alumni to shit their pants, panic, and you know, get ready to make drastic changes?
No, but it's time to... Their schedule's good enough that they have opportunities, including one coming up this weekend, which I will be at when they host the Fighting Irish, to secure an at-large bid. But it is also time to, you know, abandon notions of a top four seed, or and you know, you're kind of one loss away from saying like Big East AQ or not, you know, or nothing. So it's crazy, man. You know, it comes at you fast, and things that happen in February have meaningful effects or meaningful impact in the, you know, second Sunday in May. I got a spicy one.
All right,
for
give
you.
It to me.
This Georgetown offense feels a lot like the 2021 offense. And I talked about how I felt like Tucker Dordovic for Dylan Watson was going to be a lot like Jake Caraway for Dylan Watson. And it was going to be really valuable in certain situations. I use the term end of shot clock Dodger all the time. I was talking about it with Russell Melendez. You know, the type of guy who you put the ball on his stick, he's going to square up his defenseman, he's going to go to the goal, and he's going to get a decent, if not good, shot off. Now, two games in, Tucker Dordovic and Graham Bundy are as good at getting quality shots through their dodging and then their release on those shots as potentially any two players in college lacrosse. The problem is that when you become overly reliant, or not even overly reliant, but just when you do that too much, it comes at the expense of the other four guys on the field, their engagement in the game, how well they are feeling, how well they're developing a rhythm, how well they're feeling the actual game flow, how well their rhythm in terms of, you know, their ability to dodge their own man, dodge off the catch, move the ball to the right guy, hammer step downs, all that sort of stuff. Is impacted, and I think that's what we've seen from the Hoyas so far. You know, I don't think... Did they lose the Hopkins game because of their offense or because of their defense? I mean, what? They gave up 13 and they scored 12? Like, it's probably because of their defense, right? In this one, right, they scored 7 and they gave up 9. You lost because of your offense. And I think that, you know, there's... If they're going to make drastic changes, for me, it's the orientation of how everybody touches the ball, you know, how you distribute initiation percentage, and like how many shots you want to see each guy on your team take. TJ Haley is too good to be as much of a non-factor as he has been so far this season, and I don't want to say that I can't imagine a scenario or a change coming. But I'm hesitant. I think that I'm going to see a very similar offense on Saturday that I saw when I was watching film of this game on
Well,
Saturday.
I think there's a representation of, in those late moments in the shot clock, you resort to what you're comfortable with. And it's much harder for a shooter to become a passer than it is for a passer to become a shooter. Because when you create separation, you have the ball on your stick and you're looking to pass first. Pretty easy for the coach to say, hey, just get like one or two reps, get shots under your belt and do that. But when your mindset is shoot first, that slide's coming a hell of a lot earlier. You're pressing out on adjacents, and it's much easier to game plan for a guy who you know is going to look to shoot first than a guy who you know is going to pass first. It's what makes Tom Schreiber, I think, the best player in the world, is when he beats you, you have to cover everybody. But when Dordovic beats you, you just have to slide early and get to his hands and affect the quality of his shots. So I have Georgetown getting the brakes beat off of them this weekend in my prediction, which is completely unbiased.
Shocked.
But no, I think you're spot on, and I think that the one-headed dragon is an easy dragon to slay. I think the three-headed, four-headed ones are where you have to get problems. So, hey, you know what? Credit to Penn. I think that they have a little bit of work to do, and I think that they won... you know, just kind of the individual, one guy played better. So good for him.
Yep.
So moving through, we have a couple more to talk about. Bad weekend to be an undefeated team playing against a team wearing green. Merrimack loses to Dartmouth and Navy loses to Manhattan. I felt like this was kind of a cool opposite ends of the spectrum. you know, Navy the heavy favorite, and honestly a story about how Manhattan was able to kind of pull off a shocker of an upset, and Merrimack almost surprising that they might have been 3-0 in the first place, people starting to call them America's team. Dartmouth edges them out in an individual game. Terry, two undefeated teams lose. What does this mean for college lacrosse? Can we trust records, and does this represent any sort of parity, or was it just kind of two microcosms?
You can't trust records for sure. Like the in a 75 team league, for lack of a better word, like it's so easy to have records that are misrepresentative of how good a team is. In these cases, they're very interesting games to spotlight. You know, Dartmouth for me is one of the most unfortunate situations. They have gotten so much better, and they have made significant change to the program, right, in terms of their study abroad rules, having an indoor facility, everything else. But they have gotten better at a time when their most important competition has gotten so much better that it's like, you know, I honestly, for lack of a better way of putting it, feel bad for Brendan Callahan in the sense that, you know, it's like, you just imagine in the context of like trying to lose weight, right? You're getting in better shape, but the treadmill that you're on just go, it continues to go faster and faster and faster. And you're like, oh my God, this is insane. You know, and in a Merrimack team, McNair interviewed Mike Morgan and wrote about it this week. You know, they started 3-0. They're still not eligible for the NCAA tournament. And so, you know, just in terms of the way in which that affects your season-long motivation, how much your improvement is tied to your season-long motivation, you know, really, really significant. So, you know, this I expected Dartmouth to win this game because I expect them to be better. I think Dartmouth is very clearly a top 30 to 35 team, and I think Merrimack is, like, right there. And it was a close game, right? It was a team that had played three games versus a team that hadn't played yet, and I thought you saw that early on, and then, you know, Dartmouth closed the gap and overcame it late. Manhattan beating Navy is wild. Like, 22 saves.
What?
Right? That obviously is always going to be a factor. You know, 0 for, I believe, 23 shooting from Xavier Arline and Patrick Skalniak. I mean, I saw Navy play Queens. I thought they were fine. I wasn't impressed. I haven't expected them to be a top 20 team at all over the course of this season. You know, I think that a lot of credit goes to John Odierna and Drew Kelleher, who I mentioned is now at UMass Lowell, but got this Jasper team to the back to the NCAA tournament. I believe it was their first MAC championship. I believe that they had made it once, like in the early 2000s, but I might be misremembering that. I think Tim McEntee took them there once. It shows that, you know, their 22 season was not a fluke, that they are good, that they were not a team that was exclusively dependent on Brendan Krebs, who was a multi-year starter and put up incredible numbers. You know, 6-5, like, they didn't win the game offensively. They won it defensively, and they had a goalie that made 22 saves. So, but still, you know, an incredible victory for the program to beat, you know, a historic power like Navy and to prove, like I said, that last year wasn't a fluke.
A couple more that will fly through. Lindenwood gets its first Division I win. My big takeaway from that game, I would have loved to be in the locker room after that game. I feel like there are some victories that you win, like going into the season, it's your first time playing Division I. That first win is, you just know that you're not going to have a whole lot of them. So to get the first one under your belt, to do it in dramatic fact, you know, fashion. Have a day, fellas. Have a day. Cancel your classes. Cancel your schedule. Cancel going to the trainer tomorrow before noon and just have a great time.
How incredible is it to win your first game as a Division I program on a three-day weekend? You don't have to cancel anything. You didn't have anything scheduled for Monday.
Make it round two. Round two today, fellas. Shout out to the Lions. Hope you had a great time. Vermont beats Utah. I kind of was tagging this as like a just outside of contender matchup. I feel like Vermont and Utah, neither team's going to make the playoffs, but they have the upset potential. And another shocker, Quinnipiac beats Brown. Larkin Kemp cries tears of sadness. And then I'm going to do my best job this year to not derail this podcast about Notre Dame. We started off good. Two victories heading into a big matchup this weekend, but Lindenwood, Vermont, Utah, Quinnipiac, Brown, Notre Dame, anything of that slate of games that was of note?
Happy for Jimmy Lang. I can't believe that there are two coaches in Division I lacrosse that have the last name Poli, but Mason Poli with a big win for the Bobcats, right? Yeah, Canapiac Bobcats. You know, I've always felt like a team that can win an NCAA championship in hockey has the capacity to be really, really good in lacrosse. And there have been years when Canapiac has cycled up. And, you know, I believe last year was a struggle. So, you know, impressive to come out. But at the same time, like, you know, again, Nick DiMuccio, obviously, like, I believe he had, what, like 17 saves in the first half. You know, their resilience, right? Like, Brown made a run and they came back. You know, Brown has so many offensive personnel that they're breaking in. And Canapiac has a bunch of guys that are workhorses, you know, Tellers and a few other guys of that ilk. So keep an eye on them from the MAC standpoint. Obviously, we just talked about Manhattan, but clearly, I think I would argue that Canapiac's win over Brown was more impressive in terms of the quality of the opponent. It might be mitigated a little bit by virtue of it being the first game. And then Notre Dame, yeah, you know, the thing that I will be watching good in against Georgetown is Riccardelli's, you know, performance as the third attackman for real. Because if it is, then the issues that, you know, essentially cost, well, I mean, there are a couple of different issues that cost them those, you know, four early losses, which were ultimately season defining. You know, we talked about Will Lynch a ton on the podcast and how much better he was going to get as the year went along, and that happened. But early on, you know, it was a factor in the Georgetown and Maryland games. But ultimately, like, when you look at Jake Taylor's return from injury and the immediate explosion that the offense, you know, experienced, the way in which, again, it was kind of just that role and matchup based tiered cascading effect. Like, you know, if they have a third attackman that can produce at the level that they've seen in these first two games against top 20 competition, you know, they don't have to wait for Taylor to return in order to be a viable NCAA tournament, you know, top eight, top four seed. So that's what I'm going to be watching. And right now the early returns are positive.
Got it. I think they're the number one team in the country. I think everybody that went there is handsome, funny, talented, and certainly not overweight in any way. So the last question as we wrap things up here, you mentioned the four losses that Notre Dame suffered last year as being season defining. I very much agree. And I think the only good thing, the two good things from last season to take away. One, we realize how corrupted the organization and the selection committee is, and I think that there's a major overhaul that needs to be done about that. Again, unbiased. But two, it makes these early season games, I am way more invested in UNC Ohio State than I would have cared about last year. So the Ivies not looking great with Harvard getting smoked, Brown losing. You know, the Big Ten has good...
Albany took Cornell to the limit.
What's that?
Albany took Cornell
to
the limit.
I mean, not great for the Ivies. Big Ten has a good top with, you know, Ohio State and Maryland, but Hopkins and Rutgers not doing any favors. ACC is still plagued by Duke losing in February, Syracuse losing to Maryland, UNC losing to Ohio State. It's honestly fun to kind of watch these out-of-conference matchups now with the additional weight of how it went last year. So I would like for you to power rank the best three conferences in college across right now, top to bottom.
Top to bottom, why do we care about that? Can't we just
rank just saying top to bottom, like the entire conference as a whole.
That's what I'm saying. No, I don't want to rank the entire conference. I'm only going to rank the teams that are in NCAA tournament.
Fine, I'll allow it, but I'll allow it once, and don't get cocky.
Yeah, yeah. So top four teams. So the Ivy League's top four teams are better than the ACC's top two teams are better than the Big Ten's top three teams.
Okay.
So if we're only ranking the top, so for the Ivy League, it's Cornell, Princeton, Yale, and Penn. And then for the ACC, it's Notre Dame and Virginia. And then for the Big Ten, it's Ohio State, Maryland, and Rutgers. That's the order. It's Ivy, ACC, Big Ten.
Wrong.
If it's top to bottom, it's ACC, Big Ten, Ivy.
Okay. You saved yourself at the end right there. So you're arguing Ivy has more depth than the ACC on quality programs. Big Ten's kind of bringing up the rear with three quality teams and then a significant drop-off. But the ACC remains supreme with the 1-2 punch of Notre Dame and Virginia. Notre Dame probably deserves to be the number one, you know, after two great wins. But Any agreement with me in that these games are a little bit more objectively fun to watch? I just think they matter more. Like, I just think they do.
I'm going to take the opposite approach and say that you were just a dunce last year and didn't realize what was happening before your eyes. And you should have enjoyed them in the moment, but you didn't think that they actually mattered because you were born on this privileged mountaintop while the rest of us understood that what was actually happening on the field was compelling. But,
boy, what a sickening take that you wouldn't dare say to my face. Everybody's tough over the screen, and here comes Terry doing the...
We should plan to record this live.
Where? When? Say it.
In San Diego. In 2 weeks.
Game on, yeah. Terry. Bring your boxing gloves. Bring headgear. Bring a cup, because I'm taking low blows, but I'll allow you to finish your thought.
You know, it's year 15 for me, and honestly, like, the first 3 to 4 weeks of the season are always, I don't know, I mean, they're my favorite, they're the best. Like, no, the end of the season is awesome. Crazy stuff happens in the middle. Right, so now. I really just like lacrosse, is what I'm saying.
That's a hot boy.
But at the same time,
calm
like,
down over there.
Yeah, I know, right? Hot take. Hey, guys, I like this thing that I constantly read, talk, and write about. Here's how I would make the point that you just made. The omission of Duke and Notre Dame, this is what I've said since Selection Sunday. Like, it changed everyone's conception of what was possible. Prior to last Selection Sunday, nobody would have thought that those two teams, while on the bubble, could have been left out. So it just completely changed the stakes. The stakes are higher because it feels like anybody is gettable, right?
Mm-hmm. And, it certainly helps that granted, this is week one, but even the 2 weeks before week one have been, for lack of a better term, a beautiful shit show. We got upsets, we got undefeated teams losing, we got all kinds of stuff happening.
Should that be the title of the episode?
A beautiful shit show? I think so. I think so. And don't censor it out with like SH star asterisk T. Everybody knows what you're saying. That's not directed at you. That's just directed at people at Twitter that like, you know, oh, wow, you really...
I already had plans to edit it out.
Oh, damn it. Well, either way, I'm actually enjoying this season, especially for, February 20th right now. I haven't enjoyed college lacrosse in the first part of February to this extent in a long time. And I think it's compounding on good matchups, good upsets, and the weight of last year, even after your honestly low blow privilege comment, which I won't forget in 2 weeks.
I think that you're enjoying it more because you're getting more distance from the steely gray skies of early February in South Bend, Indiana.
No, free toughness. There's just free toughness. You don't see the sun. It's -100 degrees. You know, that's why I'm the toughest guy on Twitter.
But the wind's only blowing 35 miles an hour, so that's good.
Wow, convenient. So, either way.
Nick, as always, appreciate your time for the Tailgate Podcast. You're the man. Thank you for hosting. You're a natural. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. We'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcast and a countdown to a live tailgate in 2 weeks. See you then. Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.